Hello, and welcome to Plot Trysts.
This is Lane.
This is Meg.
And today we're reviewing The Sailor Without a Sweetheart by Katherine Brandt.
This was published in 2024 and is the fourth book in the Preston's Family series.
And full disclosure, we did receive a complimentary ARC for this review.
So, yes, we've been reading this series for a couple of years now. It's a really interesting concept for a series.
Yes.
So basically, the Prestons are this progressive family living in Regency England who have decided that they want to live as ethically as possible by basically being a self-sustaining, it's not quite democratic, but it's like a cooperative estate.
Yes.
So everyone who works on the estate gets a share of the profits. You work according to your abilities, and you know, the families they're all abolitionists, and even if they go out into society, they often will do things like they won't have sugar, they won't drink tea, because those things are imports and were created with slave labor or the slave economy.
Right.
And so each book has been about a different member of the Preston's family and about how they're navigating the world and trying to incorporate kind of their ethical ideas into their romantic relationships.
Right.
So that's the idea for the series.
And we've seen throughout the series that the children have taken different approaches to implementing their parents' ideals in their own life.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, Nate, the son this book is about, has become a British naval officer specifically looking to disrupt the transatlantic slave trade.
Right.
And so while in doing so, he's compromised on a lot of the things his family has stood for, like refusing to drink tea and coffee or wear cotton, because as an officer, he gets what the Navy gives him.
Right.
However, he has been literally raiding slave boats and freeing enslaved people.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, he's very passionate he's a very passionate abolitionist.
Yes.
And he is feeling a little frustrated at the scope of his work. Because, you know, he can't stop all slave ships.
Right.
But he feels very fulfilled when he is able to stop one and free the slaves.
Yes. Book jacket.
Let's read the book jacket. Is love worth giving a second chance? 6 years ago, Amy Lamplugh decided not to elope with Nate Preston. Ever since, she has been working hard to convince herself she was right to choose her family over Nate. Now Nate is back. After an illustrious career as a naval captain, he faces a court-martial for disobeying orders while fighting the slave trade. He accepts an invitation to await the trial at a country estate outside of Portsmouth and discovers he's suddenly neighbors with Amy.
Nate is shocked to find that Amy didn't end up marrying someone rich and titled. Instead, she is a glorified companion to her younger sister and is clearly battling some unnamed illness. Thrown together by circumstances outside their control, Nate and Amy try to be friends. Soon, it becomes clear that their feelings for each other never died. Do they dare risk their hearts again? Has anything changed, or are they destined to heartbreak once more?
I mean, that's not a bad book jacket, actually.
Honestly, I think the only problem with it is it doesn't give any context for the Prestons.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But luckily for all of you listening to this podcast, we just gave you the background so you know.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, for the book itself, I think it's very clear what's going on. I think you're right. We don't understand that part of the reason she turned him down was because he's a Preston.
Right. I just feel like whenever a series has such a defined premise,
right,
it behooves the jacket to reference that.
Exactly. Yeah, I see what you mean.
In the same way that, like, when vampire series don't reference that it's a supernatural book.
I was about to say, it's just like the ones where I'm like, they don't really say that bluebirds are vampires, right?
Right.
As usual, we generated a random number between 1 and 50, and we wrote our own summaries using that number as a word count. For this episode, the number we generated was 8. I will go ahead and start. Persuasion, if Anne Elliot got a chronic illness.
I've never read Persuasion. So I'm going to trust you.
It's so good, Lane. And this will be actually, I think, a very interesting then review because she does draw a lot from Persuasion.
Yeah, because I have no context at all.
Exactly. It'll be like our Midnight Duet review.
I don't know. I think I've at least got more phantom knowledge from like cultural osmosis.
Interesting.
I really know nothing about Persuasion.
I think you would like Persuasion, actually. So,
okay. It's one of so I'm just saying, like, Midnight Duet, I at least, like, understood the premise of Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know the premise of Persuasion.
Maybe I will tell you the premise of Persuasion as well.
Tell me after, because I do think it's interesting if you're saying this book is that heavily an illusion. Yeah. The fact that I had no context at all.
Okay, I'll tell you after.
All right, my summary. Goiters don't have the sex appeal of scars.
It is true. It is true. I am going to be honest. Just the word goiter is like supremely unsexy.
Yeah, but there's also, you know, scenes where he's kissing her neck and she's like, and his nose is right next to my goiter.
No, I know. I know. That's actually something that I thought about because I feel like if it hadn't been called a goiter and had been called like a lump or a swelling or something, I might have actually read it differently.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, I didn't hate this book at all, but mm-hmm. I think ultimately it was not enough of an escapist book for me to really enjoy it. And I think a big part of the reason I didn't like experience any degree of escapism is because the medical reality she was living with was deliberately, consistently emphasized and made really explicit.
Right.
And I understand the purpose that was serving in this book about what it's like to live with a chronic illness that no one believes you have.
Mm-hmm.
But in the context of like my romantic escapist fiction, don't need that.
Yeah. 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 I really think it, for me, I think I would have had a different relationship with some of the scenes if the actual word goiter hadn't been used. And maybe that's terrible to say, but like, you know, we actually, Lane and I were actually talking about this the other day about how like some words, like the common words that people think are terrible, like moist or whatever, that they don't really bother us. However, mm-hmm. goiter does, like just the word itself, I think is, ooh, it's a rough one.
I mean, I think they're a rough thing to have.
That too. I think it's the sound and what it is, like, match each other really well.
Yep.
Yeah.
And this book, can somebody, oh man, I don't think your Kindle will do it fast enough, the one I read on. I'd love to know how many times the word goiter appears in the text.
Oh yeah, I'd have to go grab my,
because it was a lot in. You guys, it was a lot.
Yeah like it's not, she doesn't, and I think you're right, like that was a deliberate choice. It's like, yes. Not glossed over, right.
I mean, but the whole point is everyone in her life is minimizing the severity of this illness.
Right.
And so I think Catherine Grant makes a real point to demonstrate how real her suffering is in this lived experience. And I could have done without that.
Right. Tropes. So as a Persuasion retelling, if you have read Persuasion or know anything about it, you will know that means this is a second chance romance.
Yeah, so he was 18 and she was 22, mm-hmm. and they met when he was getting ready to ship off, and they decided they were going to elope, and he was waiting for her to run away, and she sent a note with her best friend that said, never mind, not coming,
mm-hmm.
and then he shipped out, and it has been 6 years, and now they are randomly reconnected at this house party.
Yeah. There are a lot of Persuasion tropes that appear here. For example, we have the whole like Portsmouth connection. So they like, meet again in Portsmouth. He is a naval captain. She was sort of the I don't want to say the belle of the ball, but you know, now it's 8 years later and she's
6 years later.
well, in Persuasion is eight, and she's like withered on the vine, you know? So those are sort of the main similarities.
There is a waltz and a garden fondle. It is two separate nights, but it's going to count for my purposes.
It
Because
counts.
the night that they have the garden fondle, there is a planned waltz. They just skipped the waltz to get right to the fondle.
Which I will never complain about. Okay, let's talk about the book. I mean, we have talked about this before, but I feel like Cathryn Grant always takes risks in her historical romances, right?
Yes.
For example, in the last one, which was The Charmer Without a Cause, he was the hero was shorter than the heroine, for example. And in this book, she takes on some like pretty entrenched conventions of romance and turns them around. So, for example, the female main character is older than the male main character. And it's, I mean, it's interesting because again, he's when they first meet, he's 18 and she is 22.
Yeah, and this is
And
where, like, frankly, I just don't have enough, I think, understanding of what specifically those ages meant at that time. Now I feel like the difference between 18 and 22 is like massive. Like so massive. I have no idea if that's how it felt back then.
I mean, I did actually recently look up like the average age of marriage in the era, and I was higher for both sexes than we might imagine. So for men, they would be married at 28 and women 22 for the first time. Yeah, I don't know if that
Right.
really matters, but I just thought I'd throw it out there. I do think 18 would have been seen as pretty young for a man to be getting married.
But to me, it's not about like how normal it would be for marriage. I'm more talking about what life place are people of that age in? Like, what are they typically engaged in? What experiences have they had that may or may not better prepare them to be a married person? You know, right now, and this is an extremely like upper middle class perspective, but like a freshman in college versus somebody who has graduated or is in a master's program are like extremely different life places, extremely different amounts of like experienced independence, likely extremely different amounts of true financial independence, very different levels of like actual thinking about what you're going to do for a living and where you want to live. Like, the difference between 18 and 22 isn't just the difference in like brain development and the social norms. It's also a huge difference in terms of like what you have experienced in life. And I have no idea, even if it was normal for men to get married at 28 as opposed to 18, I don't know what the normal man did between 18 and 28, what they experienced, or if it was just a question of like waiting for dad to die so they had inheritance.
In this book, I feel that the age difference, for me at least, explained, or at least his age, it did explain and made it more sympathetic that she turned him down for me.
Interesting. To me, it had almost no bearing, to be honest. I just don't think I had enough context.
For me, because she, again, he hasn't actually started his career yet. Like he's about to leave on his career as a naval officer, but he hasn't done it yet. So he doesn't know what life would be like for her as a married woman, who's been cut off by her family, you know?
Yeah, I get that. I just, how do I put this? I don't feel like it was made explicit in the text that his youth and naivety had anything to do with her opinion. And I don't think it was made out in the text that she was more mature than him. Like, I agree with you that it was like the fact that he didn't have a true understanding of what she'd experienced was a factor in her decision. But I don't think the text presented it as like her life experience made him seem like a naive little boy to her.
No, and I'm not saying that that's I hope that that's not what I was implying.
No, it's not what you're saying, but I'm saying that's part of where I thought the age difference wasn't really given that much emphasis.
Yeah. And again, I don't think it was either. I think that this was I don't want to go too crazy about it, but I do think this is a way to differentiate it from Persuasion. Because in that book, you're like, why would she turn him down? You know? And here I felt like it was a little bit more understandable for her to have been swayed by her friends and family.
I mean, ultimately, again, with no knowledge of Persuasion at all, I don't think it's that unsympathetic for a 22-year-old who is clearly extremely close to her sisters and friends and has made it clear to her by her father, the only support system she's ever known, that she will be completely blacklisted. And this is a choice between everything she has ever found familiar and this one dude, to be like, I'm not in a position to make that choice.
Right.
Like, I don't think that's unsympathetic without all the additional context.
Yeah. Okay, so that's one of the things we've got. So older woman, younger man, only by 4 years. But I mean, I do think it's especially in a romance, it's unusual, right?
Right.
She has a chronic illness. Not only is it a chronic illness, it is a disfiguring illness, as we have already talked about. But this is something that you never see in a romance, right?
I mean, the only disfiguring things I've seen in romance are scars.
Mm-hmm.
They are more typically on men than on women, but not exclusively. Yep. We've had some scarred heroines. But that's the only disfiguring ailment I can think of.
Yeah, the only thing I could think of were cute, crooked teeth, which is not really disfiguring, you know?
Also not an ailment.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a spoiler, but I don't think it spoils the book, which is that by the end, she doesn't get miraculously cured.
Yep.
Right. It's not like she meets this amazing doctor who's like, this is what you need to take and this will fix you. Right? Which I feel like in most other historical romances, that's what you would read.
I do think there's a little bit of that.
There's a little bit of it, but it's not, she's not cured.
No, but the disfigurement is. I mean, she doesn't get miraculously cured in that, the underlying symptoms are still there. She is still sick.
Yeah.
But I do think it is telling that even Catherine Grant wasn't willing to leave her disfigured.
Yeah, that's true. I have a whole discussion point about why don't we have a debate over whether this is a Persuasion retelling or not, but
I'm not going to have that debate. I'm fascinated.
but I don't know. I think I would argue that this is not a Persuasion retelling, but rather that it is a Persuasion inspired novel.
Okay.
This does not, to me, feel like an Austen variation, right? Where we've got, what would happen if Elizabeth Bennet said yes to Darcy the first time he proposed? What happened after that? You know? What if they were zombies? Or what if they had dragons, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is not that. This is its own thing. I don't know. How did you feel like it, without knowing that it was a Persuasion retelling, did you feel like it stood on its own as a story?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, I thought this was a cohesive narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I struggled with, frankly, just how medically gross I sort of found it.
Right.
No offense to anyone with any of these symptoms, but again, escapism and chronic illness don't really go hand in hand.
Right.
And I kind of thought she was too much of a sad sack at times.
Right.
There were moments where I did not find, I found her self-pitying to be kind of obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, I think that means she was well-written.
Yeah.
It just means I wasn't in love with the love story.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think overall the plot absolutely stood on its own.
Yeah. One of the things I thought was really interesting about this book was the fact that Nate is facing a court-martial.
Yes. Is that in Persuasion?
That is not in Persuasion, no.
Okay.
No. In Persuasion, he I'll tell you later.
Okay.
So he's back in town to face this consequence for something that he did. And I mean, Catherine Grant always does really great historical research. And I thought the information about court martials was so interesting in this book.
Nate was really cool.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And his situation was really cool. And
yep.
Yes.
Yep. I mean, super interesting to learn about what a court martial was and when it might be decided to be like the proper course of action. And then what the courtroom was like, all that stuff. Really interesting. And also the fact that, like, he's in town to face a court martial and he's like, I get to go to a few balls, like, dance with people. People think he's, like, super hot and they're, like, still think he's a great catch, you know?
Yeah.
Super.
And the court martial is public knowledge.
Yep.
So it's not like he's hiding from the scandal of it.
No, that's the thing. Like, he's not, like, out there publicizing it, but he's also not, like, everyone knows, you know? Mm-hmm. So really interesting. I would like to have a spoiler tag. I will say here, I don't think we need a spoiler for it, but I think that one of the things that also takes place in this book that I really think is fascinating was a major discussion of consent, when you can consent, like sexual consent, and then also what is like owed sexually to you in a relationship or in a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that it was really nuanced and really interesting. And I would like to talk about it in more detail with you, but I think it needs a spoiler tag.
Okay. So put a pin in that.
Yep.
To be honest, I don't think there are any content warnings beyond that, which we've sort of discussed and are inherent to the summary.
Right.
You know, she is extremely sick. She is single in a society that looks down on women who remain single.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of accurate depictions of the problems of the time.
Yep. You know, just like, well, I would also mention that there's like very visceral discussions of like slave ships.
Yes.
For example, like Nate talks about how when you approach a slave ship, like you can smell it. It smells differently.
Yes.
Or it smells different, I should say. But it's difficult to read, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of very visceral descriptions in this text.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about sexiness, Lane.
All right. I'm going to be honest. This book did not work for me. And not because of the end, the way it ended. She came across as so, like, desperate.
Uh-huh.
That I found it all, like, profoundly not sexy even before it escalated.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're making out, and she's, like, begging him to put his dick in her, even though she's admitting in her own head she's only doing that because she overheard someone else do it once.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it didn't come off in any part that we were in her head. Did not read to me as an interaction between two people. It read to me as, like, a woman who had been so repressed by circumstance and so resentful of that she was sort of play acting desire.
I mean, I think it's interesting because
it made me really uncomfortable.
Yeah, I didn't read it that way. I there were a lot of times, I mean, almost every time that they came together sexually, she was like, this is going to be my only chance. So like, I need to, it's not that she wasn't attracted or didn't want to be with him. She like really, really wanted to. She just didn't really know the right vocabulary to get that across to him.
Right.
And yeah, that I thought that was a really unique way to approach it, right? Because,
and again, I'm not trying to discount the merits of this book existing, but every choice that was interesting that got made took it down on the sexy romance scale for me. So it was like it was one or the other, and this book went more, ooh, I've never seen a book like this before, than like telling a romance I was invested in.
Right. Yeah, so her entire relationship with Nate when they come back together is basically her thinking, I am going to take what I can get from him because I know we can't be married. The first time she assumed they were going to be married, and when she eventually turned him down, she was very upset, but she thought, you know, I'll go on to have a different life. Now she feels like her illness has, like, the fact that she has this illness precludes her from marriage to anyone, because it would be unfair to that person to be married to her, to an invalid, right?
Sure.
And so, like, everything she does with him, if she talks to him, if she walks with him, if she has tea with him, if she dances with him, she's thinking, this is, like, I need to cherish this moment because, like, this is a gift to me that I didn't think I would get to see Nate again, just to, like, be around him, right?
Right.
And that carries over into the sex as well. Yeah, so they, like, make out, and then you're right, they're out in the gardens, and she's like, I want to feel you inside me. And he's like, does she really mean that? And she doesn't mean that because she doesn't know what the heck that means, right?
And then she has a medical episode. So also. Yes.
Yep, yep. So that ends not super well.
Right.
Then they have their garden fondle, which also, I guess it's kind of what's it called? It's a trope. They go in the labyrinth, right?
Yep.
So they go in the hedge maze, and they go to the center of the labyrinth, and he goes down on her, and it's very sexy. But then she's like, okay, let's go all the way, because I want to know what it's like. And he's like, yeah, but Amy, like, you're not, like, I don't think that you're ready for it. And she's like, no, I'm totally ready. Like, I totally want to have sex. And he's like, no, I mean, like, your body is not really ready for it. And of course, this, like,
hedge maze, trying not to get caught. We don't have any things to help us here.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, I don't have any lube. Like, it's not going to work. Of course, this is like, she's like, oh my God, like, I can't even, I knew I wasn't going to get married, but I thought I could at least have sex.
Right.
So that was really upsetting. And then they have.
Which, I mean, like, it's basically the female equivalent of ED.
Yeah.
And, like, ED is never mentioned at all, male or female, in romance novels.
Yeah.
So, I mean, add it to the list of things Catherine Grant is doing that aren't usually done.
No, exactly. Well, and this is what I was going to say, too. Like, we've been talking about how indie authors are really going different places with their sex scenes because they are not making penetrative sex like the be-all and end-all of these sex scenes that we're reading, right?
Right.
And I feel like this book takes it almost to the natural conclusion, which is that maybe you can have a whole novel that is an open door explicit romance, but not having penetrative sex as the main course. So this is where I want to talk in more detail about that specific plot point. So let's have a little spoiler tag, right?
Cool.
So thank you guys so much for listening. We would love it if you would rate, review, subscribe, check us out around the internet, wherever you find plot trysts. Also, if you've read this book, definitely come back and listen to the end part of it, because this is part of the book that I appreciated a lot.
Okay.
Okay. So let's talk about it. Basically, this is the whole part that I was talking about, this thinking about consent and, like, what do you owe a partner sexually, right? Which I feel like, again, in an open door romance, there's just the expectation that you're going to have penetrative sex and that's it. And of course, we have queer romance these days where, you know, that's not, it's never on the table.
Sure.
One of the books I can think of that did it was the Marion Hayes book, remember, by Kat Sebastian?
Yeah, Robin Hood.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And this book is similar to that in that Amy not only it's like she wouldn't mind having sex, but like she can't be sexually ready. And even when they try with lube, it's like not, she's not liking it, like it's painful. And he's just like, I don't care.
Right. You know? And it's interesting, he makes it clear that he wants to marry her even if absolutely nothing sexual was ever part of the equation.
Right.
And I do think it's interesting to sort of divorce the concept of marital intimacy from physical intimacy.
Yes.
I mean, clearly she's interested, he's interested, and they are not going to be like asexual in their dynamic.
Right.
But his attitude is, I'm picking the person, and whatever can or cannot happen is sort of like a, we make it work based on what it takes for us to be together.
Yep. And part of the reason that she has been turning him down is, again, that she feels like her illness makes her, so she's like, well, I can't, probably not going to give him kids. And if I do, I'm going to die. Like, I'm going to die in childbirth. That's what
right,
she thinks happened to her mother.
Yep.
And so she thinks, well, if I can't give him children and we can't have sex, then it's not fair for me to marry him.
Well, and like that's part of it, but it's also, and I will be relegating him to a lifetime of a caretaker at my yep. whims of, am I having a good day or a bad day?
Yep. Mm-hmm. And he's really like, I just want to be with you, Amy. Like, I know that you're ill, but, you know, and I know that you might not ever be able to have sex with me. And I know you, that means we might not ever have kids. And I don't care because I want you.
Right.
I mean, ultimately, that's very romantic, you know?
Sure. So. And it's definitely under-depicted in romance novels. I do think it's interesting. Like, obviously, it's extremely innovative and, like, something I haven't seen before. But it does only discuss what's, like, physically possible in this specific scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Like, clearly she wants to, he would want to, but he's trying to teach her that her health concerns are valid and that she shouldn't push herself to the point of making herself ill
right.
in all facets of her life, including their sexual endeavor. There isn't really a discussion of like what is normal on the spectrum of like sexual desire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
this is explicitly about like her illness and validating that she is still worthy and sexual, even in the context of having limitations that she's not in control of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But I just really appreciate what Catherine Grant is doing with the romance genre.
I
really appreciated this book.
I agree. Again, I'm not, like, sad this book exists. I do feel like while Catherine Grant always pushes the envelope, in other books she has written, in my opinion, she has done a better job marrying these innovative concepts with mm-hmm. a love story I am really invested in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this book, to me, was more of just a writing exercise. I wasn't invested in the love story because I found a lot of it too visceral.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was more into the love story than you were.
Yeah. I wanted to push her off a cliff and marry Nate myself.
Oh, you see, you were into Nate.
I mean, not like that that's an overstatement. Like I think Nate as a character was interesting and complex.
Yeah.
I think Amy, I mean, well, LOL, she was, usually I'm like, the man needs therapy. Amy needed therapy.
She absolutely needed therapy. And I mean, part of it is that she was defined by her illness, but it was like a self-definition.
It's not that it's not good or valid or like relatable. It's that, you know, I don't necessarily want my romance novels to have that many legitimate issues because I just yep. want to, yeah, this is fun and sexy.
Yep. Yeah, that's fair too. Anyway,
definitely check it out yourself if any of this interested you. It is a fascinating read.
Absolutely. Totally agree.
Thanks for listening.